ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hello, I'm Tom Gilson. Today on ID, the Future, we listen in on the first half of an exchange between two scientists, both of them Christian believers, on the scientific merits of intelligent design. Günter Bechtle is a paleoentomologist who's been heard many times on ID, the Future, who says the science convinced him ID is true. S. Joshua Swamidas says ID may or may not be true in parts of what it affirms, but for him, the science sure doesn't lead you to believe in it. They met in a dialogue hosted by Justin Brierley on his unbelievable podcast at Britain's premier Christian radio.
Today on the show, we're looking at why one person does and why another doesn't endorse intelligent design. That's our subject today. Returning to this topic of intelligent design with Dr. Joshua Swamidas. He's a computational biologist, author of The Genealogical Adam and Eve, and that aims to reconcile a standard evolutionary view of human origins with the Genesis accounts. Now, last time he came on the show, it was opposite a well-known ID advocate, Mike Behe, to debate whether the microscopic machinery of our cells are better explained by intelligent design or evolution. But today he's back to engage with Dr. Günter Bechtle, a paleoentomologist who specializes in fossil history. Now, Günter is a senior fellow with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, and he believes the fossil record is better explained by intelligent design than Darwinian evolution. And Günter's explicit that he takes that stance, not for any religious reasons, but on the basis of the best science. So today we'll be finding out why Günter sides with intelligent design and Joshua doesn't. So welcome along to the programme, both Günter and Joshua. Before we hear your cases, let's meet you both again briefly. First of all, Günter, first time on the show, but I've heard of you and read your stuff before now. You haven't always been a Christian, have you? Obviously, Joshua was raised in a Christian environment, but you came to it in adult years. What could you describe what you did describe yourself as and how that changed for you?
Sure. So I was not raised as a Christian, not raised as a believer. My parents were agnostics or atheists. We actually didn't really talk about this stuff. I was not baptized, never went to some kind of religious education, never went to church as kid. And when I was, let's say, old enough intellectually to think about these questions, I self-identified as an atheist. And I had heroes like Richard Dawkins. That was basically, I had a relatively simple view on religion, the standard ideas of, let's say, the new atheist, that this is all some kind of medieval superstition and is nonsense. And I came to believe not in the usual way. It came in a long intellectual journey, which started with a kind of popular science interest in modern physics. And then I encountered problems that cannot be easily explained by materialism or naturalism. And then I started a kind of worldview quest, and this led me to over 10 or 15 years to different views, which I held then for some years, and then I gave them up because they turned out to be inconsistent. And ultimately, I arrived at some kind of generic theism as best explanation, and then I had some incentive to look into religions and to explore the particular claims, let's say, of Judaism or Christianity or Islam. And then to my great surprise, because I had no prior, let's say, kind of confirmation bias that I wanted to find Christianity to be true, rather the opposite. I didn't really like Christianity, so I was surprised to find the historical reliability of the Gospels quite well supported and the historicity of the resurrection. And so I came, in a way, against my will to a Christian belief.
Thanks for sharing that story, Günter. Jesus is good, isn't he?
I'd love to dig that into that more another day, maybe, but we'll restrict ourselves to the science and how it relates, I suppose, to Christianity at some level today. Josh, I think this must be your third time on the show, and we're going to get you back for another discussion with William Lane Craig as well on the historical Adam and Eve. But how's the book been received now? It's been over a year, I think, since it's been released. Have you been pleased with the the kinds of responses?
I've been really excited about how it's really opened up conversations in surprising ways. I think I've always said that I don't think evolution is the whole story, and people weren't really sure what it meant by that. But I do think that there's a real legitimacy to the record that we have in Scripture, and I think that people are seeing that there's a way to hold those things together. And the conversation at the Evangelical Theological Society was really strong, as was it in the American Academy for Religion, and then also the one coming up in ASA, I'm very much looking to, the American Scientific Affiliation. And I think one of the key things to see is how scholars are responding to it. There's been a few academic papers that have come out, but and already a couple books, but probably the most important book, because of its readership and its impact, is Bill Craig's book coming out in September, which where he's kind of explaining how he pulls it all together. In large part, interacting with my work, too.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to bringing you both together for a conversation on that in a month or two. But in the meantime, we're talking about intelligent design on the show today. And what I thought we'd do at the outset is give you both a bit of time to you know, put out your position. Why don't we start with Gunter and take it away, Gunter, and tell us why you do endorse intelligent design.
Right. So maybe before I start, it's always good to define some terms to not talking past each other. I suppose Josh will do the same. So what do I mean when I say Darwinism? So I don't mean common descent with modification or the tree of life, which I'm happy to affirm. I mean with Darwinism, basically a purely accidental material process of undirected transformation. And that would be especially natural selection acting on random mutation. So that would be neo-Darwinism. And that this is a sufficient explanation of macroevolution. That's what I mean with Darwinism. And the other term, design, what do I mean with design? And I don't mean with this necessarily a theological idea of, let's say, supernatural, miraculous intervention of God, but basically an infusion of information from outside of the system as best scientific explanation of the empirical data. So that would be the two terms. And we will see, actually, from what I've seen from Josh, that we have a lot in common. Josh and I, we're both Christian theists. We think that God created the universe and that he even created humans by whatever means. We are both bioscientists. We both believe in an old earth and in common descent with modification, including our own species. And we both support Darwinian and non-Darwinian evolution in terms of microevolution. And we both even seem to agree, if I don't have misunderstood Josh, that natural selection acting on random mutation is not a sufficient theory of macroevolution. So where do we disagree? So Josh thinks that other undirected processes, like, for example, neutral evolution, have superseded neo-Darwinism and that they can do the job. And I don't think that this is correct. I think that neo-Darwinism is far from dead. That is very much alive in evolutionary biology. And there are, of course, other new ideas, but Darwin's idea of this process of selection and random mutation is the only idea in 2,000 years of Western civilization that has ever been proposed to explain the origin of specified complexity from simple beginnings by a purely naturalistic bottom-up process. So we mainly disagree on the question of the adequacy and sufficiency of an unguided or undirected process of macroevolution. So now, of course, even though I'm a Christian now, like Josh, even though I have become a Christian late in life, this has been totally irrelevant, as you already indicated, for my position. So I have come to doubt Darwinism for purely scientific reasons and only became a Christian and a theist many years later. But of course, now, I still don't have theological reasons to reject Darwinism and embrace idea. I'm happy, would be happy with it in terms of biblical interpretation. So I just think that Darwinism has failed as the best scientific explanation of the data. And of course, after have becoming a Christian, now I would interpret the results from intelligent design research in terms of God being the designer. And Josh probably even would agree with that. He even doesn't exclude that God might have guided the history of life, but he thinks that science cannot show this, at least in biology. He thinks that intelligent design has failed as a kind of scientific argument. And I, on the other hand, think that there's good empirical evidence for intelligent design. So what evidence was it that convinced me? There is, of course, not a single, let's say, smoking gun evidence. It's more or less a cumulative argument. And it's a mixture of arguments that, on the one hand, show that the undirected processes are not feasible as explanation. And on the other hand, there's positive evidence for design as best explanation. So some of the evidences that convinced me initially are the classical arguments that have been brought forth for intelligent design. So it's, for example, the problem of the origin of life and of the first replicator, which are required to get this whole Darwinian process started in the first place. So they cannot be explained with Darwinism. And another is this combinatorial search space problem to get new protein folds, this rarity of islands of function in the search space. The digital code in DNA, this information problem where you find design patterns like redundancy and distributed information and data compression and error correction and name it. And then, of course, irreducible complexity, which was an idea originally suggested by Charles Darwin himself, and which is very prominent, especially in molecular machines like the bacterial flagellum. And then also causal circularity in certain processes in metabolism, like the origin of ATP, where you need basically the end product to make it. And you have this kind of chicken egg problem. But most of all, of course, it has been evidence from my own field of expertise, and that is the fossil record and paleontology. And what we find there is fossil discontinuities as a rule in all periods of Earth history, in all groups of organisms. It's not just the Cambrian explosion or the abrupt origin of flowering plants, which were called an abominable mystery by Darwin. He was bothered by this. He was already aware of this because it contradicts his indispensable assumption or prediction of gradualism, and it can no longer be explained away as an artifact of an incomplete fossil record. And these abrupt appearances of new body plans, they also imply saltational transitions. And these saltations are incompatible with an undirected bottom-up process. That's why Darwin insisted so much on gradualism and had this Latin dictum, natura non facit saltos, nature doesn't make jumps. So saltations rather imply a top-down design. And they also imply a genetic problem that is a so-called waiting time problem. So the windows of time that are established by the fossil record for certain transitions, let's say from terrestrial ancestors to fully marine whales, they are orders of magnitude too short to accommodate the waiting times to get and spread the required genetic changes that are necessary for these re-engineerings that are implied by these transitions. And this can be simply calculated with the standard apparatus of population genetics. So these two fields of inference conflict, population genetics and the fossil record, even though many people might think that they support Darwinism. And finally, there's a strange phenomenon. If we look at the divergence times based on molecular clock estimates of recent species pairs and compare it with past macroevolutionary transitions on the same time scale, so for example, from Pachycetus to a fully marine whale like Basilosaurus, then we do not find any recent species that show on the same time scale of divergence a remotely comparable morphological disparity. So, of course, you could ask why inferring design instead of just saying we don't know. It's basically because we know by our observation of the universe that there's only one known cause for this sudden increase of specified information, and that's the causal activity of intelligent agents. It's the only known cause. And so we can infer intelligent causation in terms of a inference to the best explanation. because these structures in biology have certain hallmarks of design. And everybody, even Richard Dawkins, agrees that biology looks designed. It looks, to use a metaphor of Josh, it looks more like Mount Rushmore, not like Mount Everest. And I would say when something looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, then probably it is a duck. And that's why I endorse intelligent design as a scientist.
Wow. Well, thank you. That was a really helpful and, you know, fully concise and yet, you know, very, very broad sort of a summary of why you endorse intelligent design. I'm sure we'll get into those issues of the waiting time and the fossil record and everything. We won't be able to cover everything that you mentioned, though, in that presentation. Okay, Josh, let's hand over to you. And you've had very friendly conversations with people, both on the sort of atheist naturalist end of the spectrum and those on the intelligent design and creationist end as well of the spectrum. So tell us about, why you specifically have not been persuaded by intelligent design and what sort of evolutionary process you do think makes sense of the science.
Yeah, we can definitely talk about that. And thanks for having me too. Gunter, thank you also for coming and talking with me. I'm looking forward to kind of working this out. I think the way you approach this is really helpful by trying to explain where you thought where I was coming from. And I thought your explanation was pretty good, though. There is one or two points that I think it might be helpful to clarify, because I think really what the real benefit of dialogue between us is to kind of clarify where the agreements and disagreements are. And I actually would think for as overall, high level view, I think you really hit on what the key things are. I think it really does come down to a scientific disagreement. And we actually have a great deal of agreement. And I think that that's important to map out and explain as people are watching this, because they may not be able to follow all the ins and outs of all the scientific arguments, but at least they can know where the action is and where the agreements and disagreements lie. And I also have questions for you too, just about if I'm getting it right and understanding it, both for you specifically, but more about the movement as a whole and my relationship to it. And why, and also to just get more specification on particular things you said. Does that make sense, Gunter?
Yeah, sure.
All right, great. So I think starting out with defining terms makes a lot of sense here. And what I mean by evolution is really similar to what you just said, common descent, which is the idea that, common descent with modifications is how the majority of diversity on Earth arises, or all of it. And what you're making a distinction is between evolution, which is common descent, which you don't have a problem with the idea of Darwinism, which is undirected, and natural selection acting on random mutation. Is that right, Gunter?
Yep. Or okay. Generally undirected processes of whatever kind.
So I guess the issue I would have with that is that it seems to be a bit of a conflation, because Darwinism could mean either that or that, but those are still different definitions. And I think it's very clear that there are other mechanisms in addition to random mutation and natural selection. You said that there's been no other mechanism proposed. That's not true in my reading of it. I think that there are other mechanisms. They wouldn't be directed as the way you're understanding it. So that would still be Darwinism, even though it's more than natural mutation. I mean, a natural selection acting on random mutation. Is that a good way? I mean, does that make sense?
Yeah, true. We can talk about the other processes if they have superseded neo-Darwinism.
Yeah, we can talk about them all, but I think that if you're going to try and argue against directed evolution, undirected evolution, and the only conception you have of undirected evolution is natural selection answering on random mutations, well then it's going to be a bit of a straw man argument from the get-go.
No, we can talk about it. The point is that I meant with this restriction is that I have reasons why all the other processes cannot explain the explanatory deficits of neo-Darwinism. So I don't think that it's true that there are any other processes that could. Yeah. So
I would just prefer to keep those two different definitions separate, recognizing that you mean undirected. You don't mean only natural selection versus random mutation. I would also just add, too, that it's a bit more difficult to explain what you mean by undirected, because ID advocates themselves have made clear that that it could have been preloading. I'm not advocating for preloading. I have no problem with the idea of God infusing information or miraculously creating species or whatever. But it still would be a design theory to say it was all preloaded.
Sure.
And that wouldn't be directed evolution, right?
Right, right. No disagreement here. I would be open for both possibilities, a preloaded possibility, kind of fine-tuning.
Yeah, so it really seems to be is whether... Well, yeah, so that's the issue there. I mean, and later on, I do really want to hear what you mean precisely by an infusion of information.
Right.
Because technically, most scientists would say that evolution is directed. It's directed by the environment. It's directed by natural selection. Natural selection does provide a directionality to evolution. So observing directionality isn't enough to conclude that there had to be an external infusion beyond what's gotten from the environment. But I'm willing to go with that terminology, but recognizing that technically what's actually being proposed by science is directed evolution. It's just not the type of direction you're talking about. Now, that being said...
I wouldn't disagree, but we can talk about it.
Yeah, well, that being said, the one point where I think you did misunderstand what I said is I'm not actually arguing that purely natural mechanisms are sufficient. I don't know if that's a case. I would say that I'm a really agnostic there, and I would actually be inclined to say that no, they're not. I would just say that the natural processes are a very useful scientific tool for understanding what's going on. But they're not total. They don't really rule out other processes in general. Does that make sense?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah. And by the way, when you're saying about evolution, as I just described it, is just common to something compatible, we're not unique in thinking that. Also, Michael Behe affirms this. Also, does Michael Beckley. There's also several people in ID that don't affirm common descent, but would agree that common descent is not necessarily in conflict with design. And I think from a theological point of view, this is where the biggest challenges come, not because of common descent or the Cambrian explosion, but what's going on up here at the very top with humans and apes. I think that's really where the big theological problems come for Christians. But I think there's an immense amount of evidence for that. And at some point, it'd be great to hear why you're convinced of some of that evidence, particularly for human evolution. All right, so I think this is where we agree. We agree on the age of the Earth, on common descent. We both agree that Darwinism isn't really sufficient, or science hasn't demonstrated even that purely natural evolution is sufficient. I don't think it can do that. And I think we agree on the incompleteness of science alone. And I think we also agree on the dialogue across, on the need for dialogue across disagreements. And in fact, my conversations with you, Gunter, have been really positive. I really enjoy getting to know you. And I think that there could be a lot gained from us hashing out, even if we're going to disagree in the end, just clarifying where we agree and why, and where we disagree and why. And I think it really does come down to these two issues, I think. I know you're not going to like the first one, and this may not apply to you, because I don't actually know if you take a confrontational approach. But Doug Axe in Undeniable, and also in the recent Crossway book on theistic evolution, he talks about how there's a need to have a confrontational approach to evolutionary science. And I don't think that that's actually effective, even if ID is correct. I think a conversational approach is better than a confrontational approach, because it's much more likely to bring people over to understand the arguments that are being made and help them move over to a different position. A lot of ID does seem to be oriented around a confrontational approach. You might be an exception to this, Gunter, but this does make me really concerned. Even if ID was correct, it seems that the approach that's often taken really undermines ID among the scientific community.
What do you say to that, Gunter? Would you describe your approach as confrontational or conversational or something
else?
No,
and actually we would have to talk what he means with confrontational approach, because to me it sounds like an approach, oh, we don't like the science, or we want to oppose this for some non-scientific reasons. I think that's nonsense. In science, we look at different evidences for different explanations, and then we look what is the best explanation for the available data. And if we,
the word confrontational is directly from Doug. Yeah. That's how he describes himself. He thinks that it needs to be. So I'm not interpreting him. I'm saying that he thinks that evolution needs to be confronted. And he argues specifically against Bill Craig's non-confrontational approach to it.
Yeah, but even
Bill Craig
there,
says
you would
that
have
it's
to
best to find out
because everybody is a human, and also ID proponents have, let's say, other opinions. So the question is, did he say this, let's say, from a theological perspective, which would be something totally different and has no direct necessary correlation with ID theory? Then, of course, it can be that somebody has some theological reason to have a confrontational approach to evolution because people think this brings people out of the faith or whatever. But from a scientific
I think he was arguing. Have you read that chapter in Undeniable?
Pardon?
Have you read Doug Axe's statements about a confrontational approach and why he thinks it's important?
I've read the book, but I don't remember this particular issue of confrontational approach, so you would have to update me on this.
So, I'll grant you this, Gunter. I don't actually see that in quite the same way with you, so I'm not trying to apply that term to you, if that makes sense.
Well, let's maybe leave it for the moment, because we probably need Doug Axe here to tell us exactly what he meant by a confrontational approach. We are just running up against our first break. So why don't we...
I think it really comes down to the validity of specific arguments where the disagreement is. And we can get into them, but I think it really is just a scientific disagreement where, you know, ultimately you might even be correct on certain points, Gunter, and some certain conclusions. I'm just not sure if the arguments that are being made for those conclusions are valid. Does that make sense?
Let's get into those.
That makes sense,
arguments.
And I'm happy to be incorrect. Then scientific understanding progresses, so I don't need to be correct. The important thing is what is true.
Well, let's get into some of those arguments in the next section of today's show. We're talking about intelligent design on today's program. Why Gunter Beckley endorses it? Why he became, you know, an advocate of intelligent design, especially because of his view on the fossil record and the way he doesn't believe that a Darwinian evolutionary process explains that well enough, and sort of in defense of an evolutionary Christian view is my other guest, Joshua Swamidas, today on the show, and we'll be back very shortly.
For more conversations between Christians and skeptics, subscribe to the Unbelievable podcast. And for more updates and bonus content, sign up to the Unbelievable newsletter.
We're talking about intelligent design on Unbelievable today. Last time we did sort of intelligent design in the cosmos with Stephen C. Meyer. Back this week with Dr. Gunter Beckley, who's a paleoentomologist who specializes in fossil history. And he says, as far as he can see, for a whole number of different reasons, but especially in the fossil record, there's a better explanation in terms of intelligent design than the Darwinian evolutionary model. Opposite Gunter today is Joshua Swamidas, computational biologist, author of The Genealogical Adam and Eve. And he's arguing that we can reconcile a sort of standard evolutionary view, really, with the science and with the Christian account of our origins as well. But, I mean, you've said from the outset, Gunter, that it's not a religious issue for you. And Joshua outlined a number of areas where he thinks you do have a level of agreement, things like the age of the Earth and also common descent with biomodification. Now, I suppose it's the details is where the intelligent design issue comes out, isn't it? So do you want to explain why you can perhaps agree on those sorts of things, but still hold a very different view about the details of intelligent design?
Sure, because it's always in science there's room for disagreement about the data and the best interpretation of the data. And of course, there's even in physics, which is the queen of sciences, we have different schools of thought in terms of interpretation or quantum mechanics or how to interpret space-time or whatever. So it's not like science is just one enterprise where all people agree and everybody who disagrees is outside of the realm of science. There is room for disagreement. And so one of the issues that Josh brought up is this question of why limiting this whole thing to this issue of Darwinism, of random mutation and natural selection. And I have seen some of his other talks where he said, well, Darwinism is dead since 100 years and neo-Darwinism is dead since the 1960s. And we moved beyond it. And there was Kimura in the 68 with the neutral evolution. The reason why I think that is really crucial to focus on this process of random mutation, natural selection are several. One is that there is a reason why Richard Dawkins said only Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist, or why Daniel Dennett called it Darwin's dangerous idea. There is no thought in 2,000 years of history of Western civilization, how could we explain complexity from simple beginnings by a bottom-up process? And if we look at all the other processes that Josh alluded to, so neutral evolution or different processes of the so-called extended synthesis, they can't explain those issues. And that's not just my opinion. So just to give you an idea, if we look at neo-Darwinism, it's far from that, and it's not only my colleagues in evolutionary biology, everybody, I don't know a single one who would say that Darwinism in the terms of this definition of random mutation, natural selection, is not the main process. But even if we look at a very recent paper just published 17 May 2021, by Hancock in the journal Evolution, Modern Synthesis is very much alive. From the abstract, the Modern Synthesis, that's neo-Darwinism, remains the foundation of evolutionary theory. The neo-Darwinism is alive and well. And I attended this famous conference, New Trends in Evolutionary Biology, in 2016, I think it was. And there was a strong opposition by the Darwinists against even this extended synthesis. People like Douglas Futuyma, who wrote the most well-known textbook on evolution. He is a staunch Darwinist. One of the co-authors of Josh's paper, Richard Lenski, is a staunch neo-Darwinist even. And if you look at all high school textbook or university 101 textbooks, they teach mainstream Darwinism. And there is a reason also why neutral theory isn't really popular in evolutionary biology. It's far from true that neutral evolution is some kind of reformation of Darwinism that solved the problem. First, it's very much unused in evolutionary biology in terms of macroevolution, because neutral theory cannot explain the origin of adaptive complexity. It can explain some phenomena in molecular evolution and cellular complexity. Just a moment. And that is also not just a claim from me. There has been a paper in 2018 when there was this 50-year anniversary of the neutral theory. It was in the Journal of Molecular Biology and Evolution, called The Neutral Theory in Light of Natural Selection. And here is just some notes about it. And that's a journal that is favorable to this whole thing. So from the abstract, neutral theory was supported by unreliable theoretical and empirical evidence from the beginning. We can firmly reject its universality. A more comprehensive theory must be thought. It fared poorly. It has never been, explanatory power has never been exceptional. Original lines of evidence are now falsified. It has been overwhelmingly rejected. There's a reason why all these alternatives have not replaced neo-Darwinism in terms of macroevolutionary theory. If neo-Darwinism is false, then this whole thing is over. It's not like we have many other processes that could explain an undirected process. And also this question, what is direction? Because Josh asked, what do you mean by direction? Even in neo-Darwinism, selection gives some direction. That is not meant by a directed process. The question is it goal-directed? Does it have some end goal in mind? Is it developing towards something? Not is it just having some direction like the arrow of time. The arrow of time also has a direction. It only goes into the future, not into the past, but that doesn't mean that the time is going towards some predefined goal. And I think that is the crucial issue. Do we have evidence for goal-directedness in evolution?
That was Günter Bechle and S. Joshua Swamidas discussing the scientific merits of intelligent design in the first half of a conversation hosted by Justin Brierley on his unbelievable podcast at Premier Christian Radio in Britain. We'll have the second half coming your way soon. For ID the Future, I'm Tom Gilson. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.